Side 7. Domes of Fire. The Tomili, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 242.
There's somebody in back of all this. Somebody we haven't seen or even heard of yet. We're going to have to catch one of these intermediaries of his and wring some information out of him sooner or later.
The blonde thief looked around.
What now? He asked.
How long did you say it would be until the Aetons arrived from Sarso, Zangetha? Sparhawk asked the towering Aeton.
They should arrive sometime the day after tomorrow, Sparhawk Knight.
The Aeton glanced toward the east.
Tomorrow, that is, he corrected, since it's already starting to get light.
We'll care for our wounded and wait for them then, Sparhawk decided. I like lots of friendly faces around me in times like this.
One question, Sparhawk Knight, Angessa said. Who is Anaka?
That's Sparhawk, Ulaf told him. The Styrix call him that. It means without destiny.
All men have a destiny, Ulaf Knight.
Not Sparhawk, apparently. And you have no idea how nervous that makes the gods. As Angessa had calculated, the Sarsos garrison arrived about noon the following day, and the hugely increased escort of the Queen of Alenia marched easterly. 2 days later, they crested a hill and gazed down at a marble city situated in a broad green field backed by a dark forest stretching to the horizon. Sparhawk had been sensing a familiar presence since early that morning, and he had ridden on ahead eagerly. Sifrinia was sitting on her white palfrey beside the road. She was a small, beautiful woman, with black hair, snowy skin, and deep blue eyes. She wore a white robe of a somewhat finer weave than the homespun she had normally worn in Eosia.
Hello, little mother.
He smiled, saying it as if they had been apart for no more than a week.
You've been well, I trust?
He removed his helmet.
Tolerable, Sparhawk.
Her voice was rich and had that familiar lilt.
Will you permit me to greet you?
He asked, in that formal manner all Pandions used when meeting her after a separation.
Of course, dear one.
Sparhawk dismounted, took her wrists, and turned her hands over. Then he kissed her palms in the ritual Styric greeting.
And will you bless me, little mother?
He asked. She fondly placed her hands on his temples and spoke her benediction in Styric.
Help me down, Sparhawk, she commanded.
He reached out and put his hands about her almost childlike waist. Then he lifted her easily from her saddle. Before he could set her down, however, she put her arms about his neck and kissed him, full on the lips, something she had almost never done before.
I've missed you, my dear one, she breathed. You cannot believe how I've missed you.
Part 3. Aeton. Chapter 16. The carriage came around a bend in the road and approached the spot where Sparhawk and Sifrinia waited. Elana was talking animatedly to Oscania and Emban, but she broke off suddenly, her eyes wide.
Sifrinia?
She gasped.
It is! It's Sifrinia!
Royal dignity went out the window as she scrambled down from the carriage. Brace yourself, Sparhawk cautioned with a gentle smile. Elana ran to them, threw her arms around Sifrinia's neck, and kissed her, weeping for joy. The queen's tears were not the only ones shed that afternoon. Even the hard-bitten church knights were misty-eyed for the most part. Calton went even further, and wept openly as he knelt to receive Sifrinia's blessing.
The Styric woman has a special significance, Sparhawk Knight?
Angessa asked curiously.
A very special significance, Aeton Angessa,
Sparhawk replied, watching his friends clustered around the small woman.
She touches our hearts in a profound way. We'd probably take the world apart if she asked us to.
That's a very great authority, Sparhawk Knight.
Angessa said it with some approval. Angessa respected authority.
It is indeed, my friend, Sparhawk agreed. And that's only the least of her gifts. She's wise and beautiful, and I'm at least partially convinced that she could stop the tides if she really wanted to.
She is quite small, though,
Angessa noted. Not really. In our eyes, she's at least 100 feet tall. Maybe even 200.
The Styrix are a strange people with strange powers, but I had not heard of this ability to alter their size before.
Engessa was a profoundly literal man, and hyperbole was beyond his grasp.
200, you say?
At least, Eitan.
Sephrenia was completely caught up in the outpouring of affection, and so Sparhawk was able to observe her rather closely. She had changed. She seemed more open, for one thing. No Styrix could ever completely lower his defenses among Alenes. Thousands of years of prejudice and oppression had taught them to be wary, even of those Alenes they loved the most. Sephrenia's defensive shell, a shell she had kept in place around her for so long that she had probably not even known it was there, was gone now. The doors were all open. There was something more, however. Her face had been luminous before, but now it was radiant. A kind of regretful longing had always seemed to hover in her eyes, and it was gone now. For the first time in all the years Sparhawk had known her, Sephrenia seemed complete and totally happy.
"Will this go on for long, Sparhawk Knight?"
Engessa asked politely.
"Sarsos is close at hand, but..."
He left the suggestion hanging. "I'll talk with them, Eitan. I might be able to persuade them that they can continue this later."
Sparhawk walked toward the excited group near the carriage.
"Eitan and Gessa just made an interesting suggestion," he said to them. "It's a novel idea, of course, but he pointed out that we could probably do all of this inside the walls of Sarsos, since it's so close anyway."
"I see that hasn't changed,"
Sephrenia observed to Eilana.
"Does he still make these clumsy attempts at humor every chance he gets?"
"I've been working on that, little mother," Eilana smiled. "The question I was really asking was whether or not you ladies wanted to ride on into the city, or would you like to have us set up camp for the night?"
"Spoil sport,"
Eilana accused.
"We really should go on down,"
Sephrenia told them.
"Vanyan's waiting, and you know how cross he gets when people aren't punctual."
"Vanyan?" Amban exclaimed. "I thought he'd be dead by now."
"Hardly. He's quite vigorous, actually. Very vigorous at times. He'd have come with me to meet you, but he sprained his ankle yesterday. He's been terribly brave about it, but it hurts him more than he's willing to admit."
Stragan stepped up and effortlessly lifted her into the carriage.
"What should we expect in Sarsos, dear sister?" he asked her in his flawless Styrix.
Eilana gave him a startled look.
"You've been hiding things from me, my lord Stragan. I didn't know you spoke Styrix."
"I always meant to mention it to you, your majesty, but it kept slipping my mind."
"I think you'd better be prepared for some surprises, Stragan," Sephrenia told him. "All of you should."
"What sort of surprises?" Stragan asked. "Remember that I'm a thief, Sephrenia, and surprises are very bad for thieves. Our veins tend to come untied when we're startled."
"I think you'd all better discard your preconceptions about Styrix," Sephrenia advised. "We aren't obliged to be simple and rustic here in Sarsos, so you'll find an altogether different kind of Styrix in those streets."
She seated herself in the carriage and held out her arms to Danae. The little princess climbed up into her lap and kissed her. It seemed very innocuous and perfectly natural, but Sparhawk was privately surprised that they were not surrounded by a halo of blazing light. Then Sephrenia looked at Emban.
"Oh, dear," she said. "I hadn't really counted on your being here, Your Grace. How firmly fixed are your prejudices?"
"I like you, Sephrenia," the little fat man replied.
"I resent the Styrix's stubborn refusal to accept the true faith, but I'm not really a howling bigot."
"Are you open to a suggestion, my friend?" Oscania asked.
"I'll listen."
"I'd recommend that you look upon your visit to Sarsos as a holiday, and put your theology on a shelf someplace. Look all you want, but let the things you don't like pass without comment. The Empire would really appreciate your cooperation in this Emban. Please don't stir up the Styrix. They're a very prickly people, with capabilities we don't entirely understand. Let's not precipitate avoidable explosions."
Emban opened his mouth as if to retort, but then his eyes grew troubled, and he apparently decided against it. Sparhawk conferred briefly with Oscania and Sephrenia,
and decided that the bulk of the church knights should set up camp with the Poloi outside the city. It was a precaution designed to avert incidents. Engesa sent his Etons to their garrison just north of the city wall, and the party surrounding Elana's carriage entered through an unguarded gate.
"What's the trouble, Halad?"
Sophronia asked Sparhawk's squire. The young man was looking around, frowning.
"It's really none of my business, Lady Sophronia," he said. "But are marble buildings really a good idea this far north? Aren't they awfully cold in the wintertime?"
"He's so much like his father," she smiled. "I think you've exposed one of our vanities, Halad. Actually, the buildings are made of brick. The marble's just a sheathing to make our city impressive."
"Even brick isn't too good at keeping out the cold, Lady Sophronia."
"It is when you make double walls and fill the space between those walls with a foot of plaster."
"That would take a lot of time and effort."
"You'd be amazed at the amount of time and effort people will waste for the sake of vanity, Halad. And we can always cheat a little if we have to. Our gods are fond of marble buildings, and we like to make them feel at home."
"Wood's still more practical," he said stubbornly.
"I'm sure it is, Halad, but it's so commonplace. We like to be different."
"It's different, all right."
Sarsos even smelled different. A faint miasma hung over every Elene city in the world, an unpleasant blend of sooty smoke, rotting garbage, and the effluvium from poorly constructed and infrequently drained cesspools. Sarsos, on the other hand, smelled of trees and roses. It was summer, and there were small parks and rose bushes everywhere. Elana's expression grew speculative. With a peculiar flash of insight, Sparhawk foresaw a vast program of public works looming on the horizon for the capital of Elenia. The architecture and layout of the city was subtle and highly sophisticated. The streets were broad, and, except where the inhabitants had decided otherwise for aesthetic reasons, they were straight. The buildings were all sheathed in marble, and they were fronted by graceful white pillars. This was most definitely not an Elene city. The citizens looked strangely unstirrup. Their kinsmen to the west all wore robes of lumpy white homespun. The garb was so universal as to be a kind of identifying badge. The styrics of Sarsos, however, wore silks and linens. White still appeared to be the preferred color, but there were other hues as well, blue and green and yellow, and not a few garments were a brilliant scarlet. Styric women in the west were very seldom seen, but they were much more in evidence here. They also wore colorful clothing and flowers in their hair. More than anything, however, there was a marked difference in attitude. The Styrics of the West were timid, sometimes as fearful as deer. They were meek, a meekness designed to soften Elene aggressiveness. But that very attitude quite often inflamed the Elenes all the more. The Styrics of Sarsos, on the other hand, were definitely not meek. They did not keep their eyes lowered, or speak in soft, hesitant voices. They were assertive. They argued on street corners. They laughed out loud. They walked along the broad avenues of their city with their heads held high, as if they were actually proud to be Styric. The one thing that bespoke the difference more than anything else, however, was the fact that the children played in the parks without any signs of fear. Imban's face had grown rigid, and his nostrils were pinched with anger. Sparhawk knew exactly why the Patriarch of Usera was showing so much resentment. Candor compelled him to privately admit that he shared it. All Elenes believed that Styrics were an inferior race, and despite their indoctrination, the Church Knights still shared that belief at the deepest level of their minds. Sparhawk felt the thoughts rising in him unbidden. How dare these puffed-up, loud-mouthed Styrics have a more beautiful city than any the Elenes could construct? How dare they be prosperous? How dare they be happy? How dare they strut through these streets behaving for all the world as if they were every bit as good as Elene's? Then he saw Danae looking at him sadly, and he pulled his thoughts and unspoken resentments up short. He took hold of those unattractive emotions firmly and looked at them. He didn't like what he saw very much. So long as Styrics were meek and submissive and lived in misery and rude hovels, he was more than willing to leap to their defense. But when they brazenly looked him squarely in the eye, with unbowed heads and challenging expressions, he found himself wanting to teach them lessons.
"Difficult, isn't it, Sparhawk?" Stragan said wryly. My bastardy has always made me feel a certain kinship with the downtrodden and despised. I found the towering humility of our Styric brethren so inspiring that I even went out of my way to learn their language. I'll admit that the people here set my teeth on edge, though. They all seem so disgustingly self-satisfied. Stragan, sometimes you're so civilized you make me sick. My, aren't we touchy today? Sorry. I just found something in myself that I don't like. It's making me grouchy. Stragan sighed. We should probably never look into our own hearts, Sparhawk. I don't think anybody likes everything he finds there.
Sparhawk was not the only one having trouble with the city of Sarsos and its inhabitants. Sir Bevier's face reflected the fact that he was feeling an even greater resentment than the others. His expression was shocked, even outraged.
Heard a story once, Sir Ulath said to him in that disarmingly reminiscent fashion that always signaled louder than words that Ulath was about to make a point.
That was one of Sir Ulath's characteristics. He almost never spoke unless he was trying to make a point.
It seems that there was a Deiran, an Archean, and a Thalesian. It was a long time ago, and they were all speaking in their native dialects. Anyway, they got to arguing about which of their modes of speech was God's own. They finally agreed to go to Kyrellos and ask the archprelate to put the question directly to God himself.
And? Bevier asked him.
Well, sir, everybody knows that God always answers the archprelate's questions. So the word finally came back and settled their argument once and for all.
Well?
Well, what?
What is God's native dialect?
Why, Thalesian, of course. Everybody knows that, Bevier.
Ulath was the kind of man who could say that with a perfectly straight face.
It only stands to reason, though. God was a Genidian knight before he decided to take the universe in hand. I'll bet you didn't know that, did you?
Bevier stared at him for a moment, and then began to laugh a bit sheepishly. Ulath looked at Sparhawk, and one of his eyelids closed in a slow, deliberate wink. Once again, Sparhawk felt obliged to reassess his Thalesian friend. Sophronia had a house here in Sarsos, and that was another surprise. There had always been a kind of possessionless transience about her. The house was quite large, set apart in a kind of park where tall old trees shaded gently sloping lawns and gardens and sparkling fountains. Like all the other buildings in Sarsos, Sophronia's house seemed to have been constructed of marble, and it looked very familiar.
You cheated, little mother, Calton accused her as he helped her down from the carriage.
I beg your pardon?
You imitated the Temple of Aphriel on the island we all saw in that dream. Even the colonnade along the front is the same.
I suppose you're right, dear one, but it's sort of expected here. All the members of the Council of Styricum boast about their own gods. It's expected. Our gods would feel slighted if we didn't.
You're a member of the Council here? He sounded a bit surprised.
Of course. I am the High Priestess of Aphriel, after all.
It seems a little odd to find somebody from Eosia on the ruling council of a city in Deresia.
What makes you think I came from Eosia?
You didn't?
Of course not. And the council here in Sarsos isn't just the local government. We make the decisions for all Styrics, no matter where they are. Shall we go inside? Vanyan's waiting.
She led them up the marble stairs to a broad, intricately engraved bronze door, and they went on into the house. The building was constructed around an interior courtyard, a lush garden with a marble fountain in the center. Vanyan half lay on a divan-like chair near the fountain, with his right leg propped up on a number of cushions. His ankle was swathed in bandages, and he had a disgusted expression on his face. His hair and beard were silvery now, and he looked very distinguished. His face was unlined, however. The cares that had weighed him down had been lifted, but that would hardly account for the startling change in him. Even the effects of the dreadful weight of the swords he had forced Sophronia to give him had somehow been erased. His face looked younger than Sparhawk had ever seen it. He lowered the scroll he had been reading.
"Sparhawk," he said irritably, "where have you been?"
"I'm glad to see you too, my lord," Sparhawk replied.
Vanyan looked at him sharply, and then laughed, his face a bit sheepish.
"I guess that was a little ungracious, wasn't it?
Crotchety, my lord, Elana told him. Definitely crotchety. Then she cast dignity aside, ran to him, and threw her arms about his neck. We are displeased with you, my lord Vanyan, she said in her most imperious manner. Then she kissed him soundly. You have deprived us of your counsel and your company in our hour of need. She kissed him again. It was churlish of you in the extreme to absent yourself from our side without our permission. She kissed him yet again.
Am I being reprimanded or reunited with my queen? He asked, looking a bit confused.
A little of each, my lord. She shrugged. I thought I'd save some time and take care of everything all at once. I'm really very, very glad to see you again, Vanyan, but I was most unhappy when you crept away from Sumura like a thief in the night.
We don't really do that, you know, Stragan noted cynically. After you've stolen something, the idea is to look ordinary, and creeping attracts attention.
Stragan, she said, hush. I took him away from Sumura for his health, Sophronia told her. He was dying there. I had a certain personal interest in keeping him alive, so I took him to a place where I could nurse him back to health. I badgered Afriel unmercifully for a couple of years, and she finally gave in. I can make a serious pest of myself when I want something, and I really wanted Vanyan. She made no attempt to conceal her feelings now. The years of unspoken love between her and the Pandion preceptor were out in the open. She also made no effort to conceal what was quite obviously, in both the Styric and the Aline cultures, a scandalous arrangement. She and Vanyan were openly living in sin, and neither of them showed the slightest bit of remorse about it.
How's the ankle, dear one?
She asked him.
It's swelling up again.
Didn't I tell you to soak it in ice when it did that?
I didn't have any ice.
Make some, Vanyan. You know the spell.
The ice I make doesn't seem as cold as yours, Sophronia.
His voice was plaintive.
Men, she cried in seeming exasperation, they're all such babies.
She bustled away in search of a basin.
You followed that, didn't you, Sparhawk? Vanyan said.
Of course, my lord. It was very smooth, if I may say so.
Thank you. What was that all about? Calton asked.
You'd never understand, Calton, Sparhawk replied.
Not in a million years, Vanyan added.
How did you sprain your ankle, Lord Vanyan? Barrett asked.
I was proving a point. I advised the Council of Styricum that the young men of Sarsos were in extremely poor physical condition. I had to demonstrate by outrunning the whole bloody town. I was doing fairly well until I stepped in that rabbit hole.
That's a real shame, Lord Vanyan, Calton said. As far as I know, that's the first contest you ever lost.
Who said I lost? I was far enough ahead and close enough to the finish line that I was able to hobble on and win. The council's going to at least think about some military training for the young men.
He glanced at Sparhawk's squire.
Hello, Halad, he said. How are your mothers?
Quite well, my lord. We stopped by to see them when we were taking the queen to Kyrellos, so that she could turn the arch-prelate over her knee and spank him.
Halad,
Elana protested.
Wasn't I supposed to say that, your majesty? We all thought that's what you had in mind when we left Sumura.
Well, sort of, I guess, but you're not supposed to come right out and say it like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was a good idea myself. Our holy mother needs to have something to worry about now and then. It keeps her out of mischief.
"Astonishing, Halad," Patriarch Emban murmured dryly. "You've managed to insult both church and state in under a minute."
"What's been going on in Eosia since I left?"
Vanyan demanded.
"It was just a small misunderstanding between Sarathi and me, my lord Vanyan," Elana replied. "Halad was exaggerating. He does that quite often, when he's not busy insulting the church and state at the same time."
"We may just have another Sparhawk coming up here."
Vanyan grinned.
God defend the church, Emban said.
And the crown, Elana added. Princess Danae pushed her way through to Vanyan. She was carrying Myrrh, her hand wrapped around the kitten's middle. Myrrh had a resigned expression on her furry face, and her legs dangled ungracefully.
Hello, Vanyan,
Danae said, climbing up into his lap and giving him an offhand sort of kiss.
You've grown, princess,
he smiled.
Did you expect me to shrink?
Danae, Ilana scolded.
Oh, Mother, Vanyan and I are old friends. He used to hold me when I was a baby.
Sparhawk looked carefully at his friend, trying to decide whether or not Vanyan knew about the little princess. Vanyan's face, however, revealed nothing.
I've missed you, princess, he said to her.
I know. Everybody misses me when I'm not around. Have you met Mur yet?
She's my cat. Talon gave her to me.
Wasn't that nice of him?
Very nice, Danae.
I thought so myself. Father's going to put him in training when we get home. It's probably just as well to get all that done while I'm still a little girl.
Oh? Why is that, princess?
Because I'm going to marry him when I grow up, and I'd like to have all that training nonsense out of the way. Would you like to hold my cat?
Talon blushed and laughed a bit nervously, trying to pass off Danae's announcement as some sort of little girl whim. His eyes looked a bit wild, however.
You should never warn them like that, princess,
Piranus Melodir advised.
You're supposed to wait and tell them at the last possible minute.
Oh, is that the way it's done?
Danae looked at Talon.
Why don't you forget what I just said then,
she suggested.
I'm not going to do anything about it for the next 10 or 12 years anyway.
She paused.
Or 8, maybe. There's no real point in wasting time, is there?
Talon was staring at her, with the first faint hints of terror in his eyes.
She's only teasing you, Talon, Colton assured the boy. And even if she isn't, I'm sure she'll change her mind before she gets to the dangerous age.
Never happen, Colton,
Danae told him, in a voice like steel. That evening, after arrangements had been made and the crowd had been mostly dispersed to nearby houses, Sparhawk sat in the cool garden at the center of the house with Sephrenia and Vanyan. Princess Danae sat on the ledge surrounding the fountain watching her kitten. Mur had discovered that there were goldfish swimming in the pool, and she sat with her tail twitching and her eyes wide with dreadful intent.
I need to know something before I start, Sparhawk said, looking directly at Sephrenia. How much does he know?
He pointed at Vanyan.
Just about everything, I'd say. I have no secrets from him.
That's not too specific, Sephrenia.
Sparhawk groped for a way to ask the question without revealing too much.
Oh, do get to the point, Sparhawk, Danae told him. Vanyan knows who I am. He had a little trouble with it at first, but he's more or less reconciled to the idea now.
That's not entirely true, Vanyan disagreed. You're the one with the really serious problems, though, Sparhawk. How are you managing the situation?
Badly,
Danae sniffed.
He keeps asking questions, even though he knows he won't understand the answers.
Does Ilana suspect?
Vanyan asked seriously.
Of course she doesn't,
the child goddess replied.
Sparhawk and I decided that right at the beginning. Tell them what's been happening, Sparhawk, and don't be all night about it. Mirtai's bound to come looking for me soon.
It must be pure hell, Vanyan said sympathetically to his friend.
Not entirely. I have to watch her, though. Once she had a swarm of fairies pollinating all the flowers in the palace garden.
The bees are too slow,
she shrugged.
Maybe so, but people expect the bees to do it. If you turn the job over to the fairies, there's bound to be talk.
Sparhawk leaned back and looked at Vanyan. Sephrenia has told you about the Lamorks and Drichtnoth, hasn't she?
Yes. It's not just wild stories, is it?
Sparhawk shook his head. No. We encountered some Bronze Age Lamorks outside of Demos. After Uloth brained their leader, they all vanished, except for the dead. Oskanya's convinced that it's a diversion of some kind, rather like the games Martell was playing to keep us out of Kyrellos during the election of the Archprelate. We've been catching glimpses of Krager, and that lends some weight to Oskanya's theory. But you always taught us that it's a mistake to try to fight the last war over again, so I'm not locking myself into the idea that what's happening in Lamorkand is purely diversionary. I can't really accept the notion that somebody would go to all that trouble to keep the Church Knights out of Tamale, not with the Aetons already here. Vanyan nodded. You're going to need someone to help you when you get to Mathirion, Sparhawk. Tamul culture is very subtle, and you could make some colossal blunders without even knowing it.
Thanks, Vanyan. You're not the only one, though. Your companions aren't the most diplomatic men in the world, and Ilana tends to jump fences when she gets excited.
Did she really go head-to-head with Dolmont?
Oh, yes.
Danae said. I had to kiss them both into submission before I could make peace between them.
Who'd be the best to send, Sephrenia?
Vanyan asked.
Me.
That's out of the question. I won't be separated from you again.
That's very sweet, dear one. Why don't you come along, then?
He seemed to hesitate.
Don't be such a goose, Vanyan,
Danae told him.
You won't die the minute you leave Sarsos, any more than you did when you left my island. You're completely cured now. I wasn't worried about that, he told her. But Sephrenia can't leave Sarsos anyway. She's a member of the Council of Styricum.
I've been a member of the Council of Styricum for several centuries, Vanyan,
Sephrenia told him.
I've left here before, for long periods of time on occasion. The other members of the Council understand. They've all had to do the same thing themselves now and then.
I'm a little vague on this ruling council, Sparhawk admitted. I knew that Styrix kept in touch with each other, but I hadn't realized it was quite so well-knit.
We don't make an issue of it,
Sephrenia shrugged.
If the Alenes knew about it, they'd try to make it into some huge conspiracy.
Your membership on the council keeps coming up, Sparhawk noted. Is this council really relevant, or is it just some sort of ceremonial body?
Oh, no, Sparhawk, Vanyan told him. The council's very important. Styricum's a theocracy, and the council's composed of the high priests and priestesses of the younger gods.
Being Athriel's priestess isn't really a very taxing position,
Sephrenia smiled, looking fondly at the child goddess.
She's not particularly interested in asserting herself, since she usually gets what she wants in other ways. I get certain advantages, like this house, but I have to sit on the meetings of the Thousand, and that can be tedious sometimes.
The Thousand?
It's another name for the Council.
There are 1,000 younger gods?
Sparhawk was a bit surprised at that.
Well, of course there are, Sparhawk,
Athriel told him.
Everybody knows that.
Why 1,000?
It's a nice number with a nice sound to it. In Styric, it's Agaraluan.
I'm not familiar with the word.
It means 10 times 10 times 10. Sort of. We had quite an argument with one of my cousins about it. He had a pet crocodile, and it had bitten off one of his fingers. He always had trouble counting after that. He wanted us to be Agaralican. 9 times 9 times 9. But we explained to him that there were already more of us than that, and that if we wanted to be Agaralican, some of us would have to be obliterated. We asked him if he'd care to volunteer to be one of them, and he dropped the idea.
Why would anyone want to have a pet crocodile?
It's one of the things we do. We like to make pets of animals you humans can't control. Crocodiles aren't so bad. At least you don't have to feed them.
No, but you have to count the children every morning. Now I understand why the question of whales keeps coming up.
You're being terribly stubborn about that, Sparhawk. I could really impress my family if I had a whale.
I think we're getting a little far afield, Vanyan said. Sephrenia tells me you've got some fairly exotic suspicions. I've been trying to explain something I can't completely see yet, Vanyan. It's like trying to describe a horse when all you've to work with is his tail. I've got a lot of bits and pieces, and not too much more. I'm positive that everything we've seen so far, and probably a lot of things we haven't, are all hooked together, and that there's one intelligence guiding it all. I think it's a god, Vanyan, or gods.
Are you sure your encounter with Azesh didn't make you start seeing hostile divinities under beds and in dark closets?
I have it on the very best authority that only a god could raise an entire army out of the past. The authority who told me was quite smug about it.
Be nice, Father,
Danae said primly.
It's too complex, Vanyan, she explained. When you raise an army, you have to raise each individual soldier, and you have to know everything about him when you do that. It's the details that defeat human magicians when they try it.
Any ideas? Vanyan asked his friend.
Several, Sparhawk grunted, and none of them very pleasant.
Do you remember that shadow I told you about? The one that was following me all over Eosia after I killed Gwerig?
Vanyan nodded.
We've been seeing it again, and this time everybody can see it.
That doesn't sound too good.
No, it doesn't. Last time, that shadow was the troll gods.
Vanyan shuddered. And then the both of them looked at Sephrenia.
Isn't it nice to be needed?
Danae said to her sister.
I'll talk with Celasta, Sophronia sighed. He's been keeping abreast of things here in Sarsos for the Emperor. He probably knows a great deal about this, so I'll have him stop by tomorrow.
There was a loud splash.
I told you that was going to happen, Myrrh,
Danae said smugly to the wild-eyed kitten struggling to stay afloat in the fountain. Myrrh's problems were multiplied by the fact that the goldfish were ferociously defending their domain by bumping her paws and tummy with their noses.
Fish her out, Danae, Sparhawk told her.
She'll get me all wet, Father, and then Mother will scold me. Myrrh got herself into that fix. Now let her get herself out.
She'll drown.
Oh, of course she won't, Sparhawk. She knows how to swim. Look at her. She's cat-paddling for all she's worth.
She's what?
Cat-paddling. You couldn't really call it dog-paddling, could you? She's not a dog, after all. We Styrix talk about cat-paddling all the time, don't we, Sophronia?
I never have, Sophronia murmured.
Chapter 17. A large part of the fun came from the fact that her parents could not anticipate Princess Danae's early morning visits. They were certainly not a daily occurrence, and there were times when a whole week would go by without one. This morning's visit was, of course, the same as all the rest. Consistency is one of the more important divine attributes. The door banged open, and the princess, her black hair flying and her eyes filled with glee, dashed into the room and joined her parents in bed with a great whooping leap. The leap was followed, as always, by a great deal of squirming and burrowing until Danae was firmly nestled between her parents. She never paid these visits alone. Rollo had never really been a problem. Rollo was a well-mannered toy, anxious to please, and almost never intrusive. Myrrh, on the other hand, could be a pest. She was quite fond of Sparhawk, and she was a genius at burrowing. Having a sharp-clawed kitten climb up the side of one's bare leg before one is fully awake is a startling experience. Sparhawk gritted his teeth and endured.
The birds are awake,
Danae announced it almost accusingly.
I'm so happy for them, Sparhawk said, wincing as the kitten lurking between the covers began to rhythmically flex her claws in his hip.
You're grumpy this morning, Father.
I was doing just fine until now. Please ask your cat not to use me for a pincushion.
She does it because she loves you.
That fills my heart. I'd still rather have her keep her claws to herself, though.
Is he always like this in the morning, Mother?
Sometimes,
Elana laughed, embracing the little girl.
I think it depends on what he had for supper.
Myrrh began to purr. Most adult cats purr with a certain decorous moderation. Kittens don't. On this particular morning, Danae's small cat sounded much like an approaching thunderstorm, or a grist mill with an off-center wheel.
I give up, Sparhawk said.
He threw back the covers, climbed out of bed, and pulled on a robe.
There's no sleeping with the three of you around, he accused them.
Coming, Rollo? His wife and daughter gave him a quick, startled glance, then exchanged a worried look. Sparhawk scooped up Danae's stuffed toy and ambled out of the room, holding it by one hind leg. He could hear Elana and Danae whispering as he left. He plumped the toy into a chair.
It's absolutely impossible, Rollo, old boy, he said,
making sure that his womenfolk could hear him.
I don't know how you can stand it.
There was a profound silence from the bedroom.
I think you and I should go away for a while, my friend, Sparhawk went on. They're starting to treat us like pieces of furniture.
Rollo didn't say anything, but then Rollo seldom did. Sophronia, who was standing in the doorway, however, seemed a bit startled.
Aren't you feeling well, Sparhawk?
I'm fine, little mother. Why do you ask?
He hadn't really expected anyone to witness a performance intended primarily for his wife and daughter.
You do realize that you're talking to a stuffed toy, don't you?
Sparhawk stared at Rollo in mock surprise.
Why, I believe you're right, Sophronia. How strange that I didn't notice. Maybe it has something to do with being rousted out of bed at the crack of dawn.
No matter how hard he tried to put a good face on this, it wasn't going to go very well.
What on earth are you talking about, Sparhawk?
You see, Rollo, Sparhawk said, trying to rescue something. They just don't understand. Any of them.
Prince Sparhawk?
It was Elana's maid, Aileen. She had come into the room unnoticed, and her huge eyes were concerned.
Are you all right?
Things were deteriorating all around Sparhawk. It's a long, long story, Aileen. He sighed.
Have you seen the princess, my lord?
Aileen was looking at him strangely.
She's in bed with her mother.
There was really not much left for him to salvage from the situation. I'm going to the bathhouse, if anybody cares.
And he stalked from the room, with the tatters of his dignity trailing along behind him.
The last of the Styric was an ascetic-looking man with white hair and a long silvery beard. He had the angular, uncompleted-looking face of all Styric men, shaggy black eyebrows, and a deep, rich voice. He was Sephrenia's oldest friend, and was generally conceded to be the wisest and most powerful magician in Styricum. He wore a white, cowled robe, and carried a staff, which may have been an affectation, since he was quite vigorous and did not need any aid when he walked. He spoke the Hellenic language very well, although with a heavy Styric accent. Sparhawk's party had gathered that morning in Sephrenia's interior garden to hear Zelasta explain the details of what was really going on in Tomalee.
"We can't be entirely positive if they are real or not," Zelasta was saying. "The sightings have been random and very fleeting."
"They're definitely trolls, though?" Tinian asked him.
Zelasta nodded.
"No other creature looks quite like a troll."
"That's God's own truth," Uloth murmured. "The sightings could very well have been of real trolls. Some time back they all just packed up and left the Legia. Nobody ever thought to stop one to ask him why."
"There have also been sightings of Dawn Men," Zelasta reported.
"What are they, learned one?"
Patriarch Emban asked him.
"Man-like creatures from the beginning of time, Your Grace. They're a bit bigger than trolls, but not as intelligent. They roam in packs, and they're very savage."
"We've met them, friend Zelasta," Kring said shortly. "I lost many comrades that day."
"There may not be a connection," Zelasta continued. "The trolls are contemporary creatures, but the Dawn Men definitely come from the past. Their species has been extinct for some 50 eons. There have also been some unconfirmed reports of sightings of Sirgai."
"You can mark that down as confirmed, Zelasta," Calton told him. "They provided us with some entertainment one night last week."
"They were fearsome warriors," Zelasta said.
"They might have impressed their contemporaries," Calton disagreed. "But modern tactics and weapons and equipment are a bit beyond their capabilities. Catapults and the charge of armored knights seem to baffle them."
"Just exactly who are the Sirgai, learned one?" Vanyan asked.
"I gave you the scrolls, Vanyan," Sephrenia said. "Didn't you read them?"
"I haven't gotten that far yet. Styric's a difficult language to read. Somebody should give some thought to simplifying your alphabet."
"Hold it," Sparhawk interrupted. He looked at Sephrenia.
"I've never seen you read anything," he accused her. "You wouldn't let Flute even touch a book."
"Not an Aline book, no."
"Then you can read?"
"In Styric, yes."
"Why didn't you tell us?"
"Because it wasn't really any of your business, dear one."
"You lied."
That shocked him for some reason.
"No, as a matter of fact, I didn't. I can't read Aline, largely because I don't want to. It's a graceless language, and your writings are ugly, like spiderwebs."
"You deliberately led us to believe that you were too simple to learn how to read."
"That was sort of necessary, dear one. Pandion novices aren't really very sophisticated, and you had to have something to feel superior about."
"Be nice," Vanyan murmured.
"I had to try to train a dozen generations of those great clumsy louts, Vanyan," she said with a certain asperity, "and I had to put up with their insufferable condescension in the process. Yes, Sparhawk, I can read, and I can count, and I can argue philosophy and even theology if I have to, and I am fully trained in logic."
"I don't know why you're yelling at me," he protested mildly, kissing her palms. "I've always believed you were a fairly nice lady."
He kissed her palms again.
"For a Styric, that is."
She jerked her hands out of his grasp, and then saw the grin on his face.
You're impossible,
she said, also suddenly smiling.
We were talking about the seer guy, I believe,
Stragan said smoothly.
Just exactly who are they?
They are extinct, fortunately, Zelasta replied. They were of a race that appears to have been unrelated to the other races of Deresia, neither Tommel nor Aline, and certainly not Styrek. Some have suggested that they might be distantly related to the Valesians.
I couldn't accept that, learned one,
Oscania disagreed.
The Valesians don't even have a government, and they have no concept of war. They're the happiest people in the world.
They could not in any way be related to the Seer guy.
Temperament is sometimes based on climate, Your Excellency,
Zelasta pointed out.
Valesia's a paradise, and central Seneska is not nearly so nice. Anyway, the Seer guy worshipped a hideous god named Sirgon, and, as most primitive people do, they took their name from him. All peoples are egotistical, I suppose. We are all convinced that our god is better than all the rest, and that our race is superior. The seer guy took that to extremes. We can't really probe the beliefs of an extinct people, but it appears that they even went so far as to believe that they were somehow of a different species from other humans. They also believed that all truth had been revealed to them by Sirgon, so they strongly resisted new ideas. They carried the idea of a warrior society to absurd lengths, and they were obsessed with the concept of racial purity and strove for physical perfection. Deformed babies were taken out into the desert and left to die. Soldiers who received crippling injuries in battle were killed by their friends. Women who had too many female children were strangled. They built a city-state beside the oasis of Sirga in central Seneska, and rigidly isolated themselves from other peoples and their ideas. The Seer guy were terribly afraid of ideas. Theirs was perhaps the only culture in human history that idealized stupidity. They looked upon superior intelligence as a defect, and overly bright children were killed.
Nice group, Talon murmured.
They conquered and enslaved their neighbors, of course, mostly desert nomads of indeterminate race. And there was a certain amount of interbreeding, soldiers being what they are.
But that was perfectly all right, wasn't it?
Baroness Melodir added tartly.
Rape is always permitted, isn't it?
In this case it wasn't, Baroness, Zelasta replied. Any seer guy caught fraternizing was killed on the spot.
What a refreshing idea,
she murmured.
So was the woman, of course. Despite all their best efforts, however, the seer guy did produce a number of offspring of mixed race. In their eyes, that was an abomination, and the half-breeds were killed whenever possible. In time, however, Sirgon apparently had a change of heart. He saw a use for these half-breeds. They were given some training, and became a part of the army. They were called Seneskans, and in time they came to comprise that part of the army that did all of the dirty work, and most of the dying. Sirgon had a goal, you see, the usual goal of the militaristically inclined.
World domination? Vanyan suggested.
Precisely. The Seneskans were encouraged to breed, and the Sirgai used them to expand their frontiers. They soon controlled all of the desert and began pushing at the frontiers of their neighbors. That's where we encountered them. The Sirgai weren't really prepared to come up against Styrek.
I can imagine, Tinian laughed.
Zelasta smiled briefly. It was an indulgent sort of smile, faintly tinged with a certain condescension.
The priests of Sirgon had certain limited gifts, the Styrek went on, but they were no match for what they encountered.
He sat tapping his fingertips together.
Perhaps when we examine it more closely, that's our real secret, he mused. Other people have only one god, or at the most a small group of gods. We have 1,000, who more or less get along with each other and agree in a general sort of way about what ought to be done. Anyway, the incursion of the seer guy into the land of the Styrek proved to be disastrous for them. They lost virtually all of their Seneskans, and a major portion of their full-blooded seer guy. They retreated in absolute disorder, and the younger gods decided that they ought to be encouraged to stay at home after that. No one knows to this day which of the younger gods developed the idea, but it was positively brilliant in both its simplicity and its efficacy. A large eagle flew completely around Seneca in a single day, and his shadow left an unseen mark on the ground. The mark means absolutely nothing to the Senescans or the Etons or Tamils or Styrix or Alenes or even the Arjunae. It was terribly important to the seer guy, however, because after that day any seer guy who stepped over that line died instantly. "Wait a minute," Carlton objected. "We encountered seer guy just to the west of here. How did they get across the line?" "They were from the past, Sir Carlton," Zelasta explained, spreading his hands. "We can assume that the line didn't exist for them, because the eagle had not yet made his flight when they marched north." Carlton scratched his head and sat frowning. "I'm not really all that good at logic," he confessed. "But isn't there a hole in that somewhere?"
Bevier was also struggling with it. "I think I see how it works," he said a little dubiously. "But I'll have to go over it a few times to be sure." "Logic can't answer all the questions, Sir Bevier," M. Ban advised. He hesitated. "You don't have to tell Dolmont I said that, of course," he added. "It may be that the enchantment's no longer in force," Sophronia suggested to Zelasta. "There's no real need for it, since the seer guy are extinct."
"And no way to prove it either," Uloth added. "One way or the other."
Strigan suddenly laughed.
"He's right, you know," he said. "There might very well be this dreadful curse out there that nobody even knows about, because the people it's directed at all died out thousands of years ago. What finally happened to them, learned one?" he asked Zelasta. "You said that they were extinct."
"Actually, my lord Stragan, they bred themselves out of existence."
"Isn't that a contradiction?" Tinian asked him.
"Not really. The Senescans had been very nearly wiped out, but now they were of vital importance, since they were the only troops at Sirgan's disposal who could cross the frontiers." He directed the seer guy to concentrate on breeding up new armies to these formerly despised underlings. The seer guy were perfect soldiers, who always obeyed orders to the letter. They devoted their attention to the Senescan women, even to the exclusion of their own. By the time they realized their mistake, all the seer guy women were past childbearing age. Legend has it that the last of the seer guy died about 10,000 years ago.
That raises idiocy to an art form, doesn't it? Stragan observed.
Zelasta smiled a thin sort of smile.
At any rate, what used to be Sirga is now Seneska. It's occupied by a defective mongrel race that manages to survive only because it sits astride the major trade routes between the Tamils of the east and the Alenes of the west. The rest of the world looks upon these heirs of the invincible seer guy with the deepest contempt. They are sneaky, cowardly, thieving, and disgustingly servile. A fitting fate for the offspring of a race that once thought it was divinely destined to rule the world.
History's such a gloomy subject,
Carlton sighed. Seneska's not the only place where the past is returning to haunt us, Zelasta added.
We've noticed, Tinian replied.
The Alenes in Western Astel are all convinced that Ayachin's returned.
Then you've heard of the one they call Saber? Zelasta asked. We ran across him a couple of times, Stragan laughed. I don't think he poses much of a threat. He's an adolescent poseur.
He satisfies the needs of the Western Astels, though, Tinian added. They're not exactly what you'd call deep.
I've encountered them, Zelasta said wryly.
Chimer of Daconia and Baron Perak, his spokesman, are a bit more serious, though. Chimer was one of those men on horseback who emerged from time to time in Alene societies. He subdued the other two Alene kingdoms in Western Astel, and founded one of those empires of 1,000 years that spring up from time to time and promptly fall apart when the founder dies. The hero in Edom is Incites, a Bronze Age fellow who actually managed to hand the seer guy their first defeat. The one who does his talking for him calls himself Rebal. That's not his real name, of course, Political agitators usually go by assumed names. Ayachin, Chimer, and Incites appeal to the very simplest of Aline emotional responses, muscularity primarily. I wouldn't offend you for the world, my friends, but you Alines seem to like to break things and burn down other people's houses. It's a racial flaw, Ulath conceded. The Arjunai present us with slightly different problems, Zelasta continued. They're members of the Tamil race, and their deep-seated urges are a bit more sophisticated. Tamils don't want to rule the world, they just want to own it. He smiled briefly at Oscania. The Arjunai aren't very attractive as representatives of the race, though. Their hero is the fellow who invented the slave trade. Mirtai's breath hissed sharply, and her hand went to her dagger.
Is there some problem, Etana? Oscania asked her mildly. I've had experience with the slave traders of Arjuna, Oscania, she replied shortly. Some day I hope to have more, and I won't be a child this time.
Sparhawk realized that Mirtai had never told them the story of how she had become a slave.
This Arjunai hero's of a somewhat more recent vintage than the others, Zelasta continued. He was of the 12th century. His name was Shiguan.
We've heard of him, Engesa said bleakly. His slavers used to raid the training camps of Etan children. We've more or less persuaded the Arjunai not to do that anymore.
That sounds ominous, Baroness Melodir said.
It was an absolute disaster, Baroness, Oscania told her. Some Arjunai slavers made a raid into Etan in the 17th century, and an imperial administrator got carried away by an excess of righteous indignation. He authorized the Etans to mount a punitive expedition into Arjuna.
Our people still sing songs about it, Engesa said, in an almost dreamy fashion.
Bad? Emban asked Oscania.
Unbelievable, Oscania replied. The Silias who authorized the expedition didn't realize that when you command the Etans to do something, you have to specifically prohibit certain measures. The fools simply turned them loose. They actually hanged the king of Arjuna himself, and then chased all his subjects into the southern jungle. It took us nearly 200 years to coax the Arjunai down out of the trees. The economic upheaval was a disaster for the entire continent.
These events are somewhat more recent, Zelasta noted. The Arjunai have always been slavers, and Shiguan was only one of several operating in northern Arjuna. He was an organizer more than anything else. He established the markets in Seneska and codified the bribes that protected the slave routes. The peculiar thing we face in Arjuna is that the spokesman's more important than the hero. His name is Scarpa, and he's a brilliant and dangerous man.
What about Tamil itself?
Emban asked.
And Etan?
We both seem to be immune to the disease, Your Grace, Oscania replied.
It's probably because Tamils are too egotistical for hero worship, and because the Etans of antiquity were all so much shorter than their descendants that modern Etans overlook them.
He smiled rather slyly at Engesa.
The rest of the world's breathlessly awaiting the day when the first Etan tops 10 feet. I think that's the ultimate goal for their selective breeding campaign.
He looked at Zelasta.
Your information's far more explicit than ours, learned one, he complimented the Styrek. The best efforts of the Empire have unearthed only the sketchiest of details about these people.
I have different resources at my disposal, Excellency, Zelasta replied. These figures from antiquity, however, would hardly be of any real concern. The Etans could quite easily deal with any purely military insurrection. But this isn't a totally military situation. Someone's been winnowing through the darker aspects of human imagination and spinning the horrors of folklore out of thin air. There are vampires and werewolves, ghouls, ogres, and once even a 30-foot giant. The officials shrug these sightings off as superstitious nonsense, but the common people of Tamale are in a state of abject terror. We can't be certain of the reality of any of these things, but when you mingle monsters with trolls, dawn men, and seer guy, you have total demoralization. Then, to push the whole thing over the edge, the forces of nature have been harnessed as well. There have been titanic thunderstorms, tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and even isolated eclipses. The common people of Tamale have become so fearful that they flee from rabbits and flocks of sparrows. There's no real focus to these incidents. They simply occur at random. And since there's no real plan behind them, there's no way to predict when and where they'll occur. That's what we're up against, my friends. A continent-wide campaign of terror. Part reality, part illusion, part genuine magic. If it isn't countered, and very, very soon, the people will go mad with fear. The empire will collapse, and the terror will reign supreme. And what was the bad news you had for us, Zelasta? Vanyan asked him. Zelasta smiled briefly. You are droll, Lord Vanyan, he said. You may be able to gather more information this afternoon, my friends, he told them all. You've been invited to attend the session of the Thousand. Your visit here is quite significant from a political point of view, and, although the Council seldom agrees about anything, there's a strong undercurrent of opinion that we may have a common cause with you in this matter. He paused, then sighed. I think you should be prepared for a certain amount of antagonism, he cautioned. There's a reactionary faction in the Council that begins to foam at the mouth whenever someone even mentions the word Aline. I'm sure they'll try to provoke you.
Something's happening that I don't understand, Sparhawk,
Danny murmured quietly a bit later. Sparhawk had retired to one corner of Sephrenia's little garden with one of Vanyan's Styric scrolls, and had been trying to puzzle out the Styric alphabet. Danae had found him there, and had climbed up into his lap. I thought you were all wise, he said. Isn't that supposed to be one of your characteristics?
Stop that. Something's terribly wrong here.
Why don't you talk with Zelasta about it? He's one of your worshippers, isn't he?
Whatever gave you that idea?
I thought you and he and Sephrenia grew up together in the same village.
What's that got to do with it?
I just assumed that the villagers all worshipped you. It's sort of logical that you'd choose to be born in a village of your own adherents.
You don't understand Styrix at all, do you? That's the most tedious idea I've ever heard of. A whole village of people who all worship the same god? How boring.
Aline's do it.
Aline's eat pigs, too.
What have you got against pigs? She shuddered. Who does Zelasta worship? If he's not one of your adherents.
He hasn't chosen to tell us, and it's terribly impolite to ask.
How did he get to be a member of the Thousand, then? I thought you had to be a high priest to qualify for membership.
He isn't a member. He doesn't want to be. He advises them.
She pursed her lips.
I really shouldn't say this, Sparhawk, but don't expect exalted wisdom from the Council. High priests are devout, but that doesn't require wisdom. Some of the Thousand are frighteningly stupid.
Can you get any kind of clue about which god might be at the bottom of all these disturbances?
No. Whoever it is doesn't want any of the rest of us to know his identity. And there are ways we can conceal ourselves. About all I can say is that he's not Styric. Pay very close attention at the meeting this afternoon, Sparhawk. My temperament's Styric, and there may be things I'd overlook just because I'm so used to them.
What do you want me to look for?
I don't know. Use your rudimentary intuition. Look for false notes, lapses, any kind of clue hinting at the fact that someone's not entirely what he seems to be.
Do you suspect that there might be some member of the Thousand working for the other side?
I didn't say that. I just said that there's something wrong. I'm getting another of those premonitions, like the one I had at Kotick's house. Something's not what it's supposed to be here, and I can't for the life of me tell what it is. Try to find out what it is, Sparhawk. We really need to know.
The Council of the Thousand met in a stately marble building at the very center of Sarsos. It was an imposing, even intimidating building that shouldered its way upward arrogantly. Like most public buildings, it was totally devoid of any warmth or humanity. It had wide, echoing marble corridors and huge bronze doors designed to make people feel tiny and insignificant. The actual meetings took place in a large, semicircular hall
with tier upon tier of marble benches stair-stepping up the sides. There were 10 of those tiers, naturally, and the seats on each tier were evenly spaced. It was all very logical. Architects are usually logical, since their buildings tend to collapse if they are not. At Sephrenia's suggestion, Sparhawk and the other Alenes wore simple white robes to avoid those unpleasant associations in the minds of Styrix when they were confronted by armored Alenes. The knights, however, wore chainmail and swords under their robes. The chamber was about half full, since at any given time a part of the council was off doing other things. The members of the Thousand sat or strolled about talking quietly with each other. Some moved purposefully among their colleagues, talking earnestly. Others laughed and joked. Not a few were sleeping. Zelasta led them to the front of the chamber where the chairs had been placed for them, facing the audience in a kind of semicircle.
"I have to take my seat," Sephrenia told them quietly. "Please don't take immediate action if someone insults you. There's several thousand years of resentment built up in this chamber, and some of it's bound to spill over."
She crossed the chamber to sit on one of the marble benches. Zelasta stepped to the center of the room and stood silently, making no attempt to call the assemblage to order. The traditional courtesies were obscure here. Gradually the talking tapered off, and the council members took their seats.
"If it please the council," Zelasta said in Styrix, "we are honored today by the presence of important guests." "It certainly doesn't please me," one member retorted. "These guests appear to be Alenes for the most part, and I'm not at all that interested in hobnobbing with pig-eaters."
"This promises to be moderately unpleasant," Stragan murmured. "Our Styrix cousins seem to be as capable of boorishness as we are."
Zelasta ignored the ill-mannered speaker and continued.
"Sarsos is subject to the Tamil Empire," he reminded them, "and we benefit enormously from that relationship."
"And the Tamils make sure we pay for those benefits," another member called.
Zelasta ignored that as well.
"I'm sure you'll all join with me in welcoming First Secretary Oscania, the Chief of the Imperial Foreign Service."
"I don't know what makes you so sure about that, Zelasta,"
someone shouted with a raucous laugh.
Oscania rose to his feet. "I'm overwhelmed by this demonstration of affection," he said dryly in perfect Styrix. There were catcalls from the tiers of seats. The catcalls died quite suddenly when Engessa rose to his feet and stood with his arms folded across his chest. He did not even bother to scowl at the unruly counselors.
"That's better," Oscania said. "I'm glad that the legendary courtesy of the Styrix people has finally asserted itself. If I may, I'll briefly introduce the members of our party, and then we'll place an urgent matter before you for your consideration." He briefly introduced Patriarch Emban. An angry mutter swept through the chamber.
"That's directed at the church, Your Grace," Stragan told him. "Not at you personally."
When Oscania introduced Elana, one council member on the top tier whispered a remark to those seated near him that elicited a decidedly vulgar laugh. Mirtai came to her feet like an uncoiling spring, her hands darting to her sheathed daggers. Engessa said something sharply to her in the Tamil tongue. She shook her head. Her eyes were blazing and her jaw was set. She drew a dagger. Mirtai may not have understood Styrix, but she did understand the implications of that laugh. Sparhawk rose to his feet.
"It's my place to respond, Mirtai," he reminded her.
"You will not defer to me?"
"Not this time, no. I'm sorry, but it's a sort of formal occasion, so we should observe the niceties."
He turned to look up at the insolent Styrix in the top row.
"Would you care to repeat what you just said a little louder, neighbor?" he asked in Styrix. "If it's so funny, maybe you should share it with us."
"Well, what do you know?" the fellow sneered. "A talking dog."
Sephrenia rose to her feet.
"I call upon the Thousand to observe the traditional moment of silence," she declared in Styrix.
"Who died?" the loudmouth demanded.
"You did, Camriel," she told him sweetly. "So our grief will not be excessive. This is Prince Sparhawk, the man who destroyed the elder god Azash, and you've just insulted his wife. Did you want the customary burial? Assuming that we can find enough of you to commit to the earth when he's done with you.
Camriel's jaw had dropped, and his face had gone dead white.
The rest of the council also visibly shrank back.
His name still seems to carry some weight, Ulaf noted to Tinian.
Evidently, our insolent friend up there seems to be having long, gloomy thoughts about mortality.
Counselor Camriel, Sparhawk said quite formally, let us not interrupt the deliberations of the Thousand with a purely personal matter. I'll look you up after the meeting, and we can make the necessary arrangements.
What did he say?
Ilana whispered to Stragan.
The usual, Your Majesty. I expect that Counselor Camriel's going to remember a pressing engagement on the other side of the world at any moment now.
Will the Council permit this barbarian to threaten me?
Camriel quavered. A silvery-haired Styrek on the far side of the room laughed derisively.
You personally insulted a state visitor, Camriel, he declared. The Thousand has no obligation to defend you under those circumstances. Your god has been very lax in your instruction. You're a boorish, loud-mouthed imbecile. We'll be well rid of you.
How dare you speak to me so, Mykon?
You seem dazzled by the fact that one of the gods is slightly fond of you, Camriel, Mykon drawled, and you overlook the fact that we all share that peculiar eminence here. My god loves me at least as much as your god loves you.
Mykon paused.
Probably more, actually. I'd guess that your god's having second thoughts about you at the moment. You must be a terrible embarrassment to him. But you're wasting valuable time. As soon as this meeting adjourns, I expect that Prince Sparhawk will come looking for you. With a knife. You do have a knife someplace nearby, don't you, Your Highness?
Sparhawk grinned and opened his robe slightly to reveal his sword hilt.
Splendid, old fellow. Mykon said. I'd have been glad to lend you mine, but a man always works better with his own equipment. Haven't you left yet, Camriel? If you plan to live long enough to see the sun go down, you'd best get cracking.
Counselor Camriel fled.
What happened?
Ilana demanded impatiently.
If we choose to look at it in a certain light, we could consider the counselor's flight to be a form of apology,
Stragan told her.
We do not accept apologies, Myrtai said implacably. May I chase him down and kill him, Ilana?
Why don't we just let him run for a while, Myrtai?
The queen decided.
How long?
How long would you say he's likely to run, my lord?
Ilana asked Stragan.
The rest of his life, probably, my queen.
That sounds about right to me.
The response of the Thousand to Zelasta's description of the current situation was fairly predictable, and the fact that all of the speeches showed evidence of much polishing hinted strongly that there had been few surprises in his presentation. The Thousand seemed to be divided into three factions. Predictably, there were a fair number of counselors who took the position that the Styrix could defend themselves, and that they had no real reason to become involved. Styrix had strong suspicions where Aline promises were concerned, since Aline rulers tended to forget promises made to Styrix after a crisis had passed. A second faction was more moderate. They pointed out the fact that the crisis here concerned the Tamils rather than the Alines, and that the presence of a small band of church knights from Eosia was really irrelevant. As the silvery-haired Mykon pointed out,
the Tamils may not be our friends in every sense of the word, but at least they're not our enemies. Let's not overlook the fact that their Aetons keep the Estels, the Edomish, and the Dakites from our doorstep.
Mykon was highly respected, and his opinion carried great weight in the council. There was a third faction as well, a vocal minority so rabidly anti-Aline that they even went so far as to suggest that the interests of Styricum might be better served by an alliance with the perpetrators of the outrages. Their speeches were not really intended to be taken seriously. The speakers had merely seized this opportunity to list long catalogues of grievances and to unleash diatribes of hatred and vituperation.
This is starting to get tiresome,
Stragan finally said to Sparhawk, rising to his feet.
What are you going to do? Do? Why, I'm going to respond, old boy.
He stepped to the center of the floor and stood resolutely in the face of their shouts and curses. The noise gradually subsided, more because those causing it had run out of energy than because anyone was really curious about what this elegant blonde Aline had to say.
I'm delighted to discover that all men are equally contemptible,
Stragan told them, his rich voice carrying to every corner of the hall.
I had despaired of ever finding a flaw in the Styric character, but I find that you're like all other men when you're gathered together into a mob. The outspoken and unconcealed bigotry you have revealed here this afternoon has lifted my despair and filled my heart with joy. I swoon with delight to find this cesspool of festering nastiness lurking in the Styric soul, since it proves once and for all that men are all the same, regardless of race.
There were renewed shouts of protest. The protests were laced with curses this time. Once again, Stragan waited.
I'm disappointed in you, my dear brothers, he told them finally. An Aline child of 7 could curse more inventively. Is this really the best the combined wisdom of Styricum can come up with? Is Aline bastard really all you know how to say? It doesn't even particularly insult me, because in my case it happens to be true.
He looked around, his expression urbane and just slightly superior.
I'm also a thief and a murderer, and I have a large number of unsavory habits. I've committed crimes for which there aren't even names, and you think your pallid, petty denunciations could distress me in any way? Does anyone have a meaningful accusation before I examine your failings? You've enslaved us, someone bellowed. Not me, old boy, Stragan drawled. You couldn't give me a slave. You have to feed them, you know, even when they're not working. Now then, let's step right along here. We've established the fact that I'm a thief and a murderer and a bastard. But what are you? Would the word snivelers startle you? You Styrics whine a great deal. You've carefully stored up an inventory of the abuses you've suffered in the past several thousand years, and you take a perverted pleasure in sitting in dark, smelly corners regurgitating them all, chewing them over and over like mouthfuls of stale vomit. You try to blame Aline for all your troubles. Does it surprise you to discover that I feel no guilt about the plight of the Styrics? I have more than enough guilt for things I have done, without beating my breast about things that happened 1,000 years before I was born. Frankly, my friends, all these martyred expressions bore me. Don't you ever get tired of feeling sorry for yourselves? I'm now going to offend you even more by getting right to the point. If you want to snivel, do it on your own time. We're offering you the opportunity to join with us in facing a common enemy. It's just a courtesy, you understand, because we don't really need you. Keep that firmly in view. We don't need you. Actually, you'll encumber us. I've heard a few intellectual cripples here suggest an alliance with our enemy. What makes you think he'd want you as allies? The Aline peasantry would probably be overjoyed if you tried, though, because that would give them an excuse to slaughter Styrics from here to the Straits of Thalesia. Joining with us won't ensure a lessening of Aline prejudice, but joining with our enemies will almost guarantee that 10 years from now there won't be a live Styric in any Aline kingdom in the world.
He scratched thoughtfully at his chin and looked around.
I guess that more or less covers everything, he said. Why don't you talk it over amongst yourselves? My friends and I will be leaving for Mathurian tomorrow. You might want to let us know what you've decided before we go. That's entirely up to you, of course. Words couldn't begin to express our indifference to the decisions of such an insignificant people.
He turned and offered his arm to Aelana.
Shall we leave, Your Majesty? He suggested.
What did you say to them, Stragan?
I insulted them, he shrugged, on as many levels as I possibly could. Then I threatened them with racial extinction, and then invited them to sign on as allies.
All in one speech?
He was brilliant, Your Majesty, Oscania said enthusiastically. He said some things to the Styrix that have needed saying for a long, long time.
I have certain advantages, Your Excellency, Stragan smiled. My character is so questionable that nobody expects me to be polite.
Actually, you're exquisitely courteous, Bevier disagreed.
I know, Sir Bevier, but people don't expect it of me, so they can't bring themselves to believe it.
Both Sophronia and Zelasta had icy, offended expressions on their faces that evening.
I wasn't trying to be personally insulting, Stragan assured them. I've heard any number of enlightened people say exactly the same thing. We sympathize with Styrix, but we find these interminable seizures of self-pity tedious.
You said many things that simply aren't true, you know, Sophronia accused him.
Of course I did. It was a political speech, little mother. Nobody expects a politician to tell the truth.
You were really gambling, my lord Stragan, Zelasta said critically. I nearly swallowed my tongue when you told them that the Alenes and the Tamuls were offering an alliance simply out of courtesy. When you told them that you didn't really need them, they might very well have decided to sit the whole affair out.
Not when he was holding all the rest of Styricum hostage, learned one, Oscania disagreed. It was a brilliant political speech. That not-so-subtle hint of the possibility of a new wave of Alene atrocities didn't really leave the Thousand any choice in the matter. What was the general reaction?
About what you'd expect, Your Excellency, Zelasta replied. Milord Stragan cut the ground out from under the Styric tradition of self-pity. It's very hard to play the martyr when you've just been told that it makes you look like a silly ass. There's a fit of towering resentment brewing among the Thousand. We Styrix are terribly fond of feeling sorry for ourselves, and that's been ruined now. No one ever really considered joining with the enemy, even if we knew who he was. But Stragan effectively bludgeoned us into going even further. Neutrality's out of the question now, since the Alene peasants would come to view neutrality as very nearly the same thing as actually joining with our unknown opponent. The Thousand will assist you, Your Excellency. They'll do all they can do, if only to protect our brothers and sisters in Eosia.
You've put in a full day's work, Stragan, Calton said admiringly. We could have been here for a month trying to persuade the Styrix that it was in their best interests to join us. My day isn't finished yet, Stragan told him, and the next group I have to try to persuade is much more hard-headed.
Might I be of some assistance? Zelasta offered.
I really rather doubt it, learned one. As soon as it gets dark, Talon and I have to pay a visit to the thieves of Sarsos.
There are no thieves in Sarsos, Stragan.
Stragan and Talon looked at each other, and then they burst out with howls of cynical laughter.
I just don't trust him, Sparhawk, Elana said later that night when they were in bed. There's something about him that just doesn't ring true.
I think it's his accent, love. I felt the same way until I realized that while his Alene is perfect, his accent puts emphasis on the wrong words.
Styric and Alene flow differently. Don't worry, though. Sophronia would know if Zelasta weren't to be trusted, Elana. She's known him for a long, long time.
I still don't like him, she insisted. He's so oily he gleams when the light hits him just right.
She raised one hand. And don't try to shrug it off as prejudice. I'm looking at Zelasta as a human being, not as a Styric. I just don't trust him.
That should pass after we get to know him better.
There was a knock at the door.
Are you busy?
Mirtai called.
What would we be doing at this hour?
Elana called back impishly.
Do you really want me to tell you, Elana? Talon's here. He has something you might want to know.
Send him in, Sparhawk told her.
The door opened, and Talon came into the circle of light of their single candle.
It's just like old times, Sparhawk.
How so?
Stragan and I were coming back from our meeting with the thieves, and we saw Krager in the street.
Can you believe that?
It was good to see him again. I was actually starting to miss him.
Chapter 18
We simply don't have the time, Sparhawk,
Sophronia said calmly.
I'll take time, little mother, he replied bleakly. It shouldn't take me too long. I'll stay here with Stragan, and we'll chase him down. Krager's not a Styrek, so he shouldn't be hard to find. We can catch up with you after we've caught him and wrung every drop of information out of him. I'll squeeze him so hard that his hair will bleed.
And who's going to see to Mother's safety while you're amusing yourself here, Father?
Danae asked him. She's surrounded by an army, Danae.
You're her champion, Father. Is that just some hollow title you can lay aside when something more amusing than protecting her life comes up? Sparhawk stared helplessly at his daughter. Then he slammed his fist against the wall in frustration.
You'll break your hand, Sophronia murmured.
They were in the kitchen. Sparhawk had risen early and gone looking for his tutor, to advise her of Talon's discovery, and of his own plans to make Krager answer for a long, long list of transgressions. Danae's presence was really not all that surprising.
Why didn't you rack him to death when you had your hands on him in Kyrellos, dear one?
Sophronia asked calmly.
Sophronia!
Sparhawk was more startled by the cold-blooded way she said it than by the suggestion itself.
Well, you should have, Sparhawk. Then he wouldn't keep coming back to haunt us like this. You know what Ulaf always says. Never leave a live enemy behind you.
You're starting to sound like an Aline, little mother.
Are you trying to be insulting?
Did banging your hand like that bring you to your senses, Father?
Danae asked. He sighed regretfully. You're right, of course, he admitted. I guess I got carried away. Krager's continued existence offends me for some reason. He's a loose end with bits and pieces of Martell still hanging from him. I'd sort of like to tidy that part of my life up.
Can you really make somebody's hair bleed? His daughter asked him.
I'm not sure. After I finally catch up with Krager, I'll let you know. He nursed his sore knuckles. I guess we really should get on to Matherion.
Sophronia, just how healthy is Vanyan, honestly?
Would you like a personal testimonial?
She asked him archly. That's none of my business, little mother. All I'm really asking is whether or not he's fit to travel.
Oh, yes, she smiled. More than fit.
Good. I'll be delighted to hand the rewards and satisfactions of leadership back to him.
No, absolutely not.
I beg your pardon?
Vanyan carried that burden for too many years. That's what made him sick in the first place. You might as well accept the fact that you're the Pandion preceptor now, Sparhawk. He'll advise you, certainly, but you get to make all the decisions. I'm not going to let you kill him.
Then you'll both be able to come with us to Matherion?
Of course they will, Sparhawk, Danae told him. We decided that a long time ago.
It would have been nice if somebody'd thought to tell me about it.
Why? You don't have to know everything, Father. Just do as we tell you to do.
What on earth ever possessed you to take up with this one, Sophronia? Sparhawk asked. Wasn't there any other god available? One of the troll gods, maybe?
Sparhawk!
Danae gasped. He grinned at her.
Zelasta will be coming with us as well, Sophronia said. He's been summoned back to Matherion anyway, and we really need his help.
Sparhawk frowned. That might cause some problems, little mother. Aelana doesn't trust him.
That's absolutely absurd, Sparhawk. I've known Zelasta all my life. I honestly think he'd die if I asked him to.
Has Mother given you any reason for these suspicions?
Danae asked intently. Hate at first sight, maybe. Sparhawk shrugged. His reputation as the wisest man in the world probably didn't help matters. She was probably predisposed to dislike him even before she met him.
And, of course, he's Styrek.
There was a brittle edge to Sophronia's voice.
You know Aelana better than that, Sophronia.
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.